The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. Eve Ensler is a Tony Award-winning playwright, author, performer, and activist. Her international phenomenon, The Vagina Monologues, has been published in 48 languages and performed in more than 140 countries. She is the author of the New York Times bestseller, I Am an Emotional Creature, In the Body of the World, for which she was last here, and many more books and plays. She is founder of V-Day, the global activist movement to end violence against women and girls, and 1 Billion Rising, the largest global mass action to end gender-based violence in over 200 countries. She is also a co-founder of City of Joy, a revolutionary center for women survivors of violence in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Eve's latest book, The Apology, is a powerful, life-changing examination of abuse and atonement. The Washington Post calls it a slim book of unbearable heft. And Booklist gave it a starred review, saying Ensler's transfixing, appalling, revelatory, and cathartic performance deepens her mission of transmuting her pain into clarion stories that engender understanding, openness, healing, and liberation. It's a pleasure to have her return. Please welcome Eve Ensler back to the Free Library.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that introduction. And hi, everyone. How are you? I'm very happy to be here in Philadelphia. I love Philadelphia. And thank you all for coming out tonight to hear about the book. I'm going to read my little introduction in the book, and then I'm going to push it, right? Okay. And then you're going to hear an audio, because I'm not ever going to read the book, because it has to be read in a man's voice. And then I'm going to go back and talk to you, okay? So this is my introduction in the book. I am done waiting. My father is long dead. He will never say the words to me. He will not make the apology. So it must be imagined, for it is in our imagination that we dream across boundaries, deepen the narrative, and design alternative outcomes. This letter is an invocation, a calling up. I have tried to allow my father to speak to me as he would speak. Although I have written the words I needed for my father to say to me, I had to make space for him to come through me. There is so much about him, his history, that he never shared with me, so I've had to conjure much of that as well. This letter is my attempt to endow my father with the will and the words to cross the border and speak the language of apology so that I can finally be free.
How very strange to be writing you. Am I writing to you from the grave? Or the past? Or the future? Am I writing as you? Or as you would like me to be? Or as I really am beneath my own limited understanding? And does it matter? Am I writing in a language I never spoke or understood, which you have created inside both of our minds to bridge the gaps, the failures to connect? Maybe I am writing as I truly am, as you have freed me by your witness. Or I'm not writing this at all, but simply being used as a vehicle to fulfill your own needs and version of things. You always wrote me letters. I found that peculiar and strangely moving. We lived in the same house, but you were writing to me, your little girl handwriting, attempting straight lines, but wandering all over the page. It was as if you were trying to make contact with some aspect of me, a part you could not find in the heated moments of our conflict, as if you were trying through poetry to appeal to a secret self that I had once made available to you. Usually you wrote apology letters. So fitting that you would now want an apology letter from me. You were always apologizing, begging for forgiveness. I had reduced you to a daily degrading mantra of, I'm sorry. This apology required time. It could not be rushed. Fortunately, I've had practice here, endlessly reliving and rehashing my crimes, mentally reenacting the details. I know you have said that an apology must be thorough and can only be trusted in its veracity and dedication to details. I have done my best. I have followed your very strict guidelines. Recognize what I have done as a crime. Face how deeply my actions and violations have impacted and devastated you. See you as a human being. Attempt to experience or feel what it felt like inside you. Feel profound remorse and regret over my actions. And finally, take responsibility for my actions by doing extensive work to understand what made me do what I did. I will need to go back in this letter to locate the roots of my behavior. I will be as honest as a formerly disingenuous person can be. I will attempt to proceed with neither defensiveness nor self-pity, as I understand neither will further clarify nor resolve. I would find myself sitting on your bed, somehow carried there by Shadow Man. You would pretend to be asleep, as if what was happening was not happening. You desperately wanted it and me to go away. I didn't go away. I never spoke, never uttered a sound. The silence was my power. Words would break the spell, make it real and ugly and what it was. Eve, let me say these words. I am sorry. I am sorry. Let me sit here at the final hour. Let me get it right this time. Let me be staggered by your tenderness. Let me risk fragility. Let me be rendered vulnerable. Let me be lost. Let me be still. Let me not occupy or oppress. Let me not conquer or destroy. Let me bathe in the rapture. Let me be the Father. Let me be the Father who mirrors your kind-heartedness back to you. Let me lay no claims. Let me bear witness and not invade. Eve, I free you from the covenant. I revoke the lie. I lift the curse. Old man, be gone.
So those were some excerpts. What happened in this process, and I just want to begin a little bit by saying, everything I'm talking about tonight is an offering. It's not a prescription. It's not a must-do. I'm sharing my experience. Every survivor has their own journey. Every survivor doesn't want an apology, doesn't want to hear an apology. This is what happened for me. I think two things got me to write this book. One is that I was sexually abused by my father from the time I was 5 until I was 10. And then at that point, he turned on me to really destroy evidence of everything he had already destroyed. And he physically battered me and almost murdered me a few times until I was 18. I waited my whole childhood for my father to apologize. And I think one of the reasons, besides being made to feel bad and wrong every day of my life, that I wrote apology letters was I somehow believed it would jigger his desire to write an apology to me. He never did. He's 31 years having left this world, and I'm still, before I wrote this book, I was still longing for an apology. And then the second reason I wrote this book is that I've worked for 21 years, most of my life, as a conscious person to figure out how to end violence against all women and girls. And I've seen women over these many years breaking the silence, telling their stories, sharing our hearts and minds, figuring out how to open shelters, how to build hotlines, doing everything in our power to end violence against women. And it occurred to me that in all this time, and particularly with the new amazing iteration of the Me Too movement, I had never heard a man give an authentic, thorough, public apology for sexual abuse or any kind of crimes of that nature. And I always ask audiences, have you ever heard it? And there's one man back. Oh, were you raising your hand? Usually people say no. And I thought to myself, okay, we're here now in this movement. We've done all this work. But if we don't move to the next level of reckoning, of accountability, of apologizing, how are we going to move forward? So those were the streams that came together to encourage me and provoke me to write my father's apology to me. And I literally went into a deep trance state for 4 months, and I literally went inside my father, and my father came inside me. And in many ways, I feel like my father wrote this book. There was much about him I didn't know that I conjured. There was a lot about him that I did know. But the process of writing this book was one of the most painful, revelatory, and liberating experiences of my life. And I want to say that my early years were brutal and full of terror and pain. My father sexually abused me, as I said. This abuse completely altered the constitutional makeup of my entire being. It filled my cells and blood and body with terror, worry, guilt, and dread that later in my teenage years and on until my 60s would develop into an all-encompassing self-hatred and anxiety. The abuse created infections in my body and seriously compromised my immune system. In my 50s, I got stage 3/4 uterine cancer, which almost killed me. The abuse froze me and made it almost impossible to concentrate or think, and it had a terrible impact on my ability to study and learn. This confirmed, of course, my father's idea of me as a stupid person. The abuse made intimacy claustrophobic, made love foreign, made safety a pipe dream, and drew me constantly to dangerous situations and people in an attempt to master my past and my fear. It eventually led me to addiction, drugs, sex, and alcohol. I tell you this not for your pity or sorrow, but I tell you this because when we talk about violence against women, it's so abstract. We use terms like gender violence, but we don't realize the specific detailed ways it impacts our lives and how many years, how much time it takes to rise from the ashes. I've been blessed that for years I was able to waitress in early days and make enough money to survive, and doubly blessed that I made my way as a writer so I could afford eventually to pay for the resources, therapy and such, to help me lift the lid of this very dark period of my life. I know others are not so fortunate, and I know if we lived in the world I imagine, we would take at least 70% of the money we spend on bombs and missiles and grenades and guns and war and killing, and we would redirect it into a national trauma fund so all those who are suffering from some kind of trauma, whether it be physical or sexual violence, ancestral violence, racial or gender violence, could have the means and resources and love and attention to recover. It would be our national priority. Alongside the Green New Deal, which is actually a form of apology to our Mother Earth. Can you imagine the outcome of a country that treated the trauma of its citizens rather than punishing them for being wounded or poor or mentally ill or homeless or broke or deprived or angry or women or African Americans or Mexicans or Muslims or violent? As I said, I've spent my life climbing out of the hole of the betrayal and terror, finding a way back into my body. I've done breath work, a massage, dance therapy, group therapy, incest therapy, anger therapy, individual therapy. I've written books and plays, and I've helped start movements to end violence against women and traveled the world to meet women in refugee camps, war zones, shelters, homeless centers, detention centers, and prisons. I confronted my mother for not protecting me, and through time and careful work, we made peace before she died. But my father died 31 years ago, and for those years, I waited and waited for him to be accountable. So many of us have been waiting for so long. I'm here with my dear sister and colleague, Monique Wilson, who's a leader in the Gabriela movement, in the women's rights movement in the Philippines, and a wonderful actress. And we have both spent much time with the comfort women in the Philippines and Asia, who were women who were held by the Japanese government in World War II in rape camps for years, who were some of them in their teens and early 20s were raped up to 50 times a day. And those women have literally been waiting for 70 years for an apology from the Japanese government. Many of them have died. Many of them are infirmed. There are only a few left. And all they want is an apology. All they want is to hear the words, to receive the apology. It's not just the acknowledgement of the offense we crave. It's the consciousness and transformation. It's the understanding. It's the detailed inquiry of the perpetrator into the whys and whats and hows. It's his complete willingness to probe his soul, wrestle down the demons and the guilt that arise and the self-loathing that comes with awareness. The words are the easy part. is the authenticity attached to the claim. It's the sweating of his hands, the impossibility of speech, the recognition of the horror, his clear understanding of the impact and longevity of his cruelty. It isn't groveling or shame I hungered for, although both would have been appropriate. It was certainly not self-immolation or self-pity, as both would demand, be a demand on my heart and sympathy, and this was a moment not for my father, but for me. This was the moment where my father would give himself to a reckoning without reservation, without justification. The apology required his attention, devotion, clarity, derived from utter self-interrogation. It could not be faked. It could not be mimed. It required time. It could not be rushed. My father, the one imagined, the one inside me, had to spend his days reliving his crimes, mentally reenacting the details, because I want to tell you, the details, it is in the details that the liberation comes when one makes an apology. He had to feel what it must have been like inside me, his daughter, who he abused. He had to strip away his hardness, which prevented him from empathy, the indifference that rejected responsibility, rejected even the notion of the apology itself. I asked him to remember my cries and pleading, and to look back and see my face, what it looked like when he demeaned or insulted or grabbed me or beat me or raped me. I asked him to meditate and try to feel and experience what it was like inside my body as I experienced the terror, rage, confusion, claustrophobia, heartbreak, and betrayal. It had to be thorough. The liberation, as I said, for both of us, came through the details. I've traveled the world and I've asked many women, I ask this question all the time, what would justice look like for you after you've been sexually abused or battered or incested or harassed? Some women rightfully want punishment, prison time for their perpetrators, public exposure, loss of jobs, end of careers. Some women simply want their perpetrators to disappear forever. But most women I've spoken to say that in order to heal, in order to move on, what they need and want is for their perpetrator to acknowledge the truth of what he's done. They want their perpetrator to recognize them as a full and real human being, to acknowledge the harm he has caused. They need to see their perpetrator has taken responsibility for his actions and done extensive work to understand what made him commit that violence. They need to know the depth of his reckoning will prevent him from ever committing that violence again. So I asked myself, what is an apology? Because as I wrote this, I had to kind of do an anatomy of an apology. And I want to say we teach children how to pray. We teach them devotion, we teach them attention, we teach them the humbling of the petition. But we don't teach children the practice of apology. It's a journey, it's a practice. It's an admission of wrongdoings, it's a humbling, it's a loss of grandiosity and superiority, it's a surrender, it's an equalizer. An apology is the antidote to convenient and diabolical amnesia which our families and our country are ripe with. I mean, we only have to look at the history of this country, beginning with the robbing of the lands from the indigenous and the way we raped and pillaged and destroyed the people who were here, moving on to 400 years of slavery and Jim Crow and mass incarceration, and how we never grapple or remember or apologize for what has been. And then, with this new iteration, with this new particular predator in chief, we don't even remember what's happened yesterday. And in our families, we deny everything that goes on as it's going on. I think one of the great things about an apology, it is the antidote to amnesia. It actually acknowledges that what happened actually did happen. It acknowledges the past and it brings us into the present. The powerful, of course, have been trained never to apologize. They make themselves the victims. That's what my father did. Even as he whipped me and threw me against walls, he was the victim. Reminding me always how it hurt him more than it hurt me, how I was the reason he had to behave like this. I made him do it. He had no choice. And so we wait for the apology. Millions of us suspended in this realm, neither past, present, or future. True, some of the accused have lost jobs and careers and reputations. Many of them, particularly white men, have gotten them back fairly quickly. Some have gone to prison, but even when they come forward to describe what they have learned, and I've read a few men who've come out to say that they had done things and they're talking about it afterwards, they don't say the words. They don't acknowledge the specificity of their crimes. They don't trace the history of their own stories or development of distortions in their own psyches that would at least attempt to make sense of their brutality. They don't investigate the system of patriarchy and privilege that allowed them, encouraged them, and gave them cover. They don't wrestle down their demons and expose vulnerability. Instead, when called out, they often speak of their own pain and loss and misfortune steeped in self-pity. I have read no words of any man accused of sexual abuse who has taken the painstaking steps to self-revelation, who has done the treacherous work of owning his actions, searching his history, facing his violence, and speaking the words in making the apology. And I don't know if it's simply ignorance or inability or shame or male entitlement or refusal or arrogance, or that men are simply unable to face so much pain, or they have been so trained to hold on to their pride and power to the final hour. My father said a very eerie thing to me in this book. He said that for a man to apologize is to become a traitor to all men. Once one man admits he was wrong and he knew what he was doing was wrong, the whole story begins to collapse. So to some degree, I believe the turning of the new world is based on this notion of apology. Maybe they believe that one apology will bring the whole world crashing down around them, and even though in some cases the world has already crashed, maybe it's the misstep that would permanently exile them from the boys' club to which their allegiance is firm and implicit. And I have to say, I think we're at a point in humanity where men have to make a choice now between their allegiance to the legion of men and patriarchy or their allegiance to redeeming and cleaning up and reckoning and being accountable for the suffering of women. That to make the apology for many women, men shows weakness, would open a floodgate to a future where their identity would be in question, would be new. So we really need the brave men to come forward now, to be the truth tellers, the traitors. I'm sure then, and I'm convinced of this, that others will follow. And I have to say, since the book came out, I'm shocked to see how many men have been asking to do interviews about the book. And how in the course of these conversations, they're talking about how they really want to find a pathway to begin to talk about who they are as men and what they've done, but they're scared. And it's interesting because they keep saying, but we need an invitation, we need to, and I keep saying, well, we didn't get an invitation. When we came out to tell our stories, when we broke the silence, you've got to be brave. You got to brave up now and come out and begin this process. I think in many ways it's clear that the system has to change, the fundamental beliefs, the values, and the central idea. The real question we're up against right now is how do we address patriarchy, the paradigm that underlines all of this violence? We have to get under the story in order to uproot it rather than continuing to ram up against it. We have to offer a doorway rather than a locked cell. We have to move from humiliation to revelation, from curtailing behavior to changing it, from containing perpetrators to calling them to reckoning. And the truth is, the system of patriarchy, as I learned writing this book, is as poisonous, if not more so, to the winners as it is to the losers. As devastating to the men who are severed from their hearts and their tenderness as it is to the women who suffer terrible violence as a result of that separation. Women spend our lives recovering from sexual violence, but men spend their lives covering for it. And both these things empty and take our lives. The truest healing is when the victim and for the perpetrator at once, because both are forever caught in the same story. Punishment cannot offer this healing. And I think one of the things my father really told me in this book, and he explained his life without justifying it, was that he was brought up as a boy who was not loved. He was adored. And adoration isn't love. Adoration is a projection of someone onto you which puts you up on a pedestal and refuses to allow you essentially to be a human being. You're not allowed to be lost, you're not allowed to be tender, you're not allowed to be vulnerable, you're not allowed to be weak. And so what do you do with all those feelings? You bury them, you push them down. And for my father, they eventually metastasized into what he called the shadow man. This character, this dark being that lived inside him, which was really catalyzed by my birth. Because when he saw me, his baby daughter, it evoked so much tenderness in him that he didn't know what to do with that tenderness because he had never allowed himself to experience tenderness. He had killed off the tenderness inside him. And so what he wanted to do was kill it off or take it or possess it or rape it or destroy it or have it, because he didn't know how to sit with it, because he had never learned to sit with his own tenderness. Men are afraid now, and I think they're confused now. They don't know how to act. And of course, having a new awareness is always a good thing, but being on guard doesn't necessarily mean being aware of the issues, doesn't assure being educated or taking responsibility or exploring your inner depths to see where you are sexist or culpable or how your actions have hurt someone and where you need to make repairs. Being on guard usually means you don't screw up, you make a mistake or get caught. It's a punishment response. You're in fear, on hold, suspended. It's not a state of mind where you can become vulnerable and learn. I can tell you that because I lived in punishment every day of my life. I believe the deeper process that is being called for now in our culture and really in many cultures can be rooted in the apology. For an apology is an excavation insisting that the perpetrator go beneath the surface, be willing to mine the layers of truth and guilt hidden beneath each new revelation. It's a method and a practice, and it holds the possibility of transformation and liberation. I've been waiting, and perhaps my life has only been about waiting on some level, dreaming of the reckoning, dreaming of the purging, dreaming of the accounting of the connection, the intimacy that only an apology can bring. Writing this book brought me to that place. I had to enter the wound, and I think I woke up about a week ago, and I had this amazing image in the middle of my third eye, and it was like this incredible mandala. And in the center of the mandala, there was another circle, and there was a portal inside that circle, and I realized I was looking at the wound. And I realized that there was an opening in the center of the wound, and that if we go through the wound, we actually get to the other side. When we park our cars or park our bicycles right next to the wound, we remain in suffering. And this book took me through the wound, and I have to say, my father's gone. And at the end of this book, when he says to me, "Old man, be gone," I felt like Peter Pan. Remember at the end of Peter Pan, Tinkerbell goes goodbye and just goes shoop, into the ethers? That's what happened with my father. And he hasn't been back. Cornel West once said, we have to make a courageous, creative, unflinching look at catastrophe. And I feel that's what I had to do. I had to remake myself and my idea of myself and break the vice of my lifelong identity being victim to my father's perpetrator. And I'll tell you something else I discovered. We have our perpetrators inside us. If we've been raped, if we've been beaten, if we've been incested, people enter us and they live in us. They occupy us. And whether we know it or not, we're in conscious or unconscious dialogue with those perpetrators our whole life. I can't tell you how many things I've done where at the end I say, "You see, you were wrong. I didn't fail. I'm not stupid. You didn't," you know, I'm always in that dialogue. And what I realized writing this book, we can actually shift how the perpetrator lives inside us. We can move them from a monolithic monster to an apologist. We can move them from this terrifying, reigning entity to a broken, vulnerable human being. And by doing that, we take agency over how they live in us. I discovered that my father was part of me, but at the end of all this, he became the part of me I wanted him to be. I know even the desire for an apology is a tall order, right? I know what I'm calling out for. It would mean, at the very least, a remaking of human consciousness. It would mean becoming vulnerable and lost and risking that the exploration and expurgation could potentially mean a radical change or identity of position. But it could also mean being involved in a process which has the possibility of bringing us into a time where the tyranny of misogyny, which has robbed men of their hearts and tenderness and humanity, is transformed into a time of equality, peace, and loving connection between men and all women. Our imagination is our most powerful weapon. We can conjure the dead, and I have to tell you, the dead are all around us. That's what I discovered writing this book. They actually need to be in dialogue with us, particularly those that are trying to get free. We can rewrite their stories with them. We can make them see us as they have never seen us. We can get them to reveal themselves and see themselves, and we can transform the underlying narrative that has caught us in a cycle of violence, punishment, and more violence. I often ask myself, what am I doing here on earth? I know you all ask yourself this question regularly, particularly in the times that we're living in. I realize my answer is very simple. I am here to get free. Free of my rancor, free of my pain, free of racism and reversing the legacy I carry as a white person, free of prejudice and unkindness, free of my self-loathing, free of my desire to hurt, free to live in my body, free of jealousy, free of not feeling like enough, free of comparison, free to be my authentic self, free to serve that which is divine. Only then can I manifest my real purpose, our only real purpose, which is to love. And I don't mean a sentimental, touchy-feely kind of love. I mean a fierce love, a love born in the alchemy of the wound, of the shadow, of the shamanic fire, of the true and radiant apology. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So we're going to take questions now. And I'm going to ask if, I know people will want to tell stories, but I feel like we don't have enough time to really go into them. So if you can stick to questions, that would be really nice.
Hi, Miss. What's your third eye like? I was listening to you very closely.
What's
you mentioned about your third eye. What's that? According to your perception, third eye.
Oh, my third eye.
Yeah.
It's the part of you that's right here. It's behind. Do you ever have a vision like behind? It's sort of like when you close your eyes, you see something right here.
Okay.
Yeah.
But that's a theoretical explanation. But what is your perception of your third eye?
Oh. I see it as the mystical center of my being.
Okay. Apology is not going to happen on its own. You have to make a paradigm shift on the other person's psyche, and. Like, how do you expect other person to apologize if he does not realize it? The paradigm shift.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so how do you get a person to apologize who doesn't think he needs to apologize? This is a, yeah. I think what I'm talking about is when a person knows they have done something wrong, there are many people out there who have done crimes and violence against women. And I believe most or many men know what they have done is wrong. And what I'm talking about is going through a process of going inside yourself to understand and investigate and self-interrogate, to understand the roots of what you've done, to take responsibility in detailing an account of what you've done, and to make amends for what you've done, and to feel what your victim feels, and to open your heart to her. That's what I'm talking about.
Hi. I'm about to go to college in the fall, and it's really interesting to hear a woman so, I mean, you're not old, but you've lived a long time.
I am old.
You lived so much longer than me. And I'm scared to embrace the world because I've already had men take advantage of me at such a young age. And I'm basically asking, what would you tell your 18-year-old self? What advice would you offer her?
Oh, that's a beautiful question. I would tell my 18-year-old self that I have value, that my life is worthy, that my body is beautiful, that I have meaning, that no one has a right to do anything to me that I don't give them consent to do, that if anybody does that, I have the right and my obligation and responsibility to report that, that I should surround myself with women and men who cherish me and celebrate me and honor me, and those are the only circles I should be in. And that I shouldn't do anything to harm my body or to harm anybody else. Thank you for asking that question. Find a sisterhood. Find women. Find women who can be your posse and protect you and lift you up. And only find friends who really want you to be your best self and really want you to thrive.
Where did you find your strength and where did you find your support to keep going, because it was 13 years that you lived in an abusive situation?
Mm-hmm. It's a very good question. I was telling this story last night, which I'll tell you. I think I found my strength through two things when I was a child. One, through writing and having a book where I could create this alternative persona. I found it through my imagination. And I'll tell you this little story because I love the story so much. When things would get really, really bad in my house, I would do one of two things. I would split off. I would go into the mirror. Because you know when you live with an alcoholic parent, for those of you who have grown up with one, you always know what their moods are based on the tone of their voice. Or you can tell how many drinks somebody has had based by their footsteps or their loudness or the tremble in their voice. And so when I knew my father was pumping it up and I could hear him beginning to call me, I would go into the mirror and I would talk to myself and I would literally say, you are going to go away now. You're not going to be in your body. You're not going to feel whatever he does to you. He will not make you cry. You will not feel pain. Okay, that was not a good response, but it saved me. And for many years later, I had to begin to weave those two parts of myself back together. But the best part was that I had this imaginary friend named Mr. Alligator. And when it got really bad, I would go and I would pick up the phone. In those days, they were rotary dials. And I would dial the phone and I would say, Mr. Alligator, and I would say it really loudly so that they would know I was calling him. I'm ready. I'll be outside in 5 minutes. I need to go. And they made fun of it. They thought it was hysterically pathetic. But I would pack my little bag. I would literally put crayons and an orange in it. And I would go out and there was a pathway right through our front lawn, and I would walk down the pathway and I would sit down and I would literally wait the entire day for Mr. Alligator to come. And you know, he didn't come then, and each time I did it, he didn't come, but I knew he was coming. And I, every single time, would just go and I would wait for Mr. Alligator to come. And I never was disappointed because I just knew something had held him up, or he had other children to take care of, or someone had it worse off than me, or I had always reasons why he didn't come. So cut to 40 years later, I'm in Narok, Kenya. I'm doing a research for a play I wrote called The Good Body, and I'm hearing about all kinds of women who are both torturing their bodies and women who are loving their bodies, and I'm visiting all these people all over the planet. And I hear about a woman named Agnes Pareo, who is working in Narok to stop the process and the practice of female genital mutilation on little girls. And for those of you who don't know what it is, little girls have their vaginas mutilated when they're coming of age, at the point where they're supposed to go to school, so that they will be not sexually active, they will no longer have sexual desires, and their clitoris is removed, and sometimes they're sewn together with thorns, and it's a horrible practice, and often on the wedding night, the husband punctures the thorns, so they're ripped apart, they often die in childbirth, they have terrible infections, and this practice has happened to 130 million girls. And Agnes was in Narok working on this practice, and she literally was walking through the Maasai Rift Valley, because she was a Maasai, teaching young Maasai families and older Maasai families what the practice was. And as she walked, she had a box, which was an anatomical structure of a vagina. And she would walk into communities and she would show people what a healthy vagina was and what a mutilated one. And as she walked through the Rift Valley, because the Maasai are nomads and they build their huts out of cow dung, and once the cow dung dissolves, they go on and they build new huts. She had saved 1,500 girls from being cut. And when I met her, I fell in love with her. And I was like, Agnes, what can we do for you? And she said, well, Eve, if you got me money, I could get a Jeep and I could get around a lot faster. So the first year, we bought Agnes a Jeep, and in that year, she saved three times as many girls. And I said, okay, Agnes, what else can we do for you? And she said, well, if you gave me money, we could build a house, and we could have girls run away, and we could keep them here, and then we could reconcile them later on with their families. So V-Day bought her a house and gave her the money, and she built a house. And for many, many years, Agnes has saved thousands of girls. And I have to tell you, when she started, 80% of people in Kenya were mutilated, and it's now 20%. And she is now the head of the Female Genital Mutilation, Anti-Female MGM Commission of Kenya. When she began, she was exiled, and she was completely, you know, thwarted. But I'll tell you what was amazing about this. The day that the V-Day Safe House opened in Kenya, I arrived, and I heard all this amazing singing and dancing. And I got out of the car, and everything was red, red costumes, red flying things, red. And all the girls were dressed in red, and they were dancing and singing, and they were just greeting me. And I looked down, and it was the exact same path of my childhood. And I realized that Mr. Alligator had come. And that is the power of the imagination. That is the power of conjuring. If we see things and we hold them in our third eye, in our imagination, we can manifest them. And I think imagination is absolutely what saved my life. And I think there were loving people, a few loving people who intervened and were kind to me and showed me that people could be different.
My question is two parts. The first is, what are your thoughts on forgiveness? And the second is, after receiving the apology, do you forgive your dad?
Do I what? Forgive my dad? I'm really mixed on the word forgiveness. And I'll tell you why. I think it's been used often as a tool against us. We're told a lot, why don't you just forgive him already? Get over it. What are you making such a fuss about? Move on. Right? It's kind of used as a mandate, you know? Like, you are mandated to forgive. And that never worked for me because it doesn't feel organic. I do believe in the alchemy of the apology. And what I mean by that is that when you receive a thorough, authentic apology, you know it. And something happens in your body, in your being, in your mind, in your soul. There is a release that occurs in that moment. You don't feel angry anymore. You don't feel vindictive anymore. You don't feel anything, but it's over. And that is as close as I understand to forgiveness. But I don't think we can get to forgiveness. I think we skip over the hard part, which is the apology part, which is the reckoning part, which is the accountability part. And I think that kind of forgiveness feels hollow to me, and it doesn't feel real to me, and it feels like it's forced. And about my father, all I can describe to you is it's over. He's gone. It's done. I lived in that paradigm of me being a victim to his perpetrator for 60 years. And I have to tell you, I'm not in that paradigm anymore. And I don't know where I am. I walk around every day going, okay, those were the borders of the frame of my life. Like, I knew who I was. I've been working to end violence against women every day of my life for 12 hours a day. I've written about it. And now, I have other interests. And not that I don't care, and not that I'm not committed to that for the rest of my life, but suddenly I feel like the world's gone, whew, it's opened up. And I want to write about things I've never wanted to write about, and I want to think about things, and I love nature, and I want to bow down to nature, and I want to hug trees every minute. Like, something has been born in me. And in that sense, you can call that forgiveness, you can call that release, you can call that story over.
Man in the audio talked about covenant. What's the nature of this covenant?
And that man is a beautiful man, Eduardo Ballerino, who reads my father's letter on audio, and he did such a beautiful job. My father says during the book that when he incested me, we made a covenant. Of course, he made the covenant. I was 5 years old. I wasn't really up for the covenant. But that we had this bond. We had this agreement that I was his and he was mine. And that covenant actually swallowed my life to some degree because I felt so possessed by it, you know, and occupied by it. So at the end of the book, he says, I free you from the covenant. I free you from this curse, essentially, that I put upon you. And that's what that means.
What if you want or need an apology from someone who's alive? I feel like it'd be a lot easier if they were dead, and then I could, you know, do this imagining. But it seems a lot harder when you have to continue to interact with somebody and have a relationship with somebody. And I'm just wondering if you think you can go through a similar process with somebody who's living and have that freeing experience.
It's a very good question. A journalist in London wrote that she thinks every victim should send this to their perpetrator anonymously, and I thought that was a brilliant idea, and I would strongly suggest it just to get the wheels moving. But what I would say is this: if you believe that person is open to an apology and would want to go on the journey of the apology, I would suggest that you send in the book. And you say to them, are you open to working with your clergy, with a therapist, with somebody who would take you through a journey where you could do a reckoning and a self-interrogation and self-investigation to make the kind of apology I need? And if you are, I would be willing to receive that. And see if they're willing. And all you can do is ask. I would do it with a partner who's with you and supporting you in doing it, so you protect yourself and you always have an ally in that process. You know, it's very funny. When I was in fifth grade, I got stripped by three boys in my class in front of the whole school. And it was a really horrible experience, and my father blamed it on me. And I was really obsessed with this for a long time. It was a profoundly humiliating experience. And when I wrote the vagina monologues, because the monologues are based on interviews, but they're all fictional literary pieces, and I created this character called Andy Lefkoff, who was a combination of the two names of the boys who had stripped me. And about 5 years after the play was playing off-Broadway, I got a letter from one of them. And he said, "I think you were talking about me. And I did a terrible thing to you. And I've been haunted by it my whole life. And I want to apologize." And he went into a deep apology. And it was so profound. And I let it go. And the other night, I was doing a reading, and his wife came up to me. And she said, "I know what my husband did to you. And he really wanted to come tonight, but he's still ashamed to see you." And I said, "Tell him he doesn't have to be ashamed anymore. He apologized. It's done." And I could tell her whole face just relaxed, because she was carrying that. She, as a woman, was carrying that burden. Do you know? So I think when we offer people the ability to do authentic apologies, we relieve them, we relieve their families, relieve all the people around them who are carrying the burdens of their bad deeds. I don't think any of us get out of this world without the shame, blame, guilt of terrible things we've done. And the catalyst for making the apology is to free yourself from the poisons and the contaminants that are destroying your life.
Did you expect or receive an apology from your mother?
I did. My mother died 9 years ago during my chemotherapy. It was a very, very bizarre experience. I was really sick and she died. But before she died, I went and I had a very profoundly difficult meeting with her years before that, where I told her everything my father had done to me. And it was probably one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life. And she, at first, first of course, she acknowledged all the beatings because she was there and in some ways supported them. You know, she was kind of a bit of an enabler of them. And at first she tried to deny the sexual violence, and then later called me up that same night at 4 a.m, and she said all the signs were there. You had infections, you had nightmares every night, your personality completely changed, you were suicidal. Of course, this happened. And she told me something very bizarre, that before my father died, a few days before he died, he told her to take me out of any will he had and not to leave me any money. And he said, "And furthermore, if she ever tells you anything about me, it's a lie." And my mother said, had he not said that, she wouldn't have believed me. So we then began to engage in a process of really talking to each other and me sharing how abandoned and betrayed I felt by her and how painful it was. And she told me at a certain point, and I really feel this in my heart, how painful it was, that she had been a very poor woman who had grown up in the Midwest, and my father was a very charming, wealthy, middle class, but upper middle class executive, and he was her path out of poverty. And she had 3 children, and she said, "Where was I going to go with 3 children? And she said, "To be honest, I sacrificed you. I sacrificed you." And as painful as those words were to hear, I knew they were the truth. And in that moment, again, I released my mother because she told me the truth. And before she died, we had a beautiful, beautiful coming together, very beautiful. And again, I released her. And I think she released me. And I think she left this world and left me in a very good way.
Just a quick question. When did your mom know about your situation?
Not until I was older, much older.
How
old? What she said is that she didn't know, but she said, I should have known, because all the signs were, and we don't know what people know, and what is denial, right? What is denial? We see things in front of us all the time. Do we all know that there are children in cages at the border? Do we know that they are holding 1,500 boys, undocumented beautiful boys, in an old Walmart's in Brownsville, Texas, where they're being treated worse than products? Do we know this? It's all in front of us, but what do we choose to see? What do we choose to see as people, as culture, as individuals? And so I know people live in families where they know bad things are going on, but they don't ever talk about it. And they don't want to talk about it because there will be consequences. We don't talk about this current predator-in-chief because so many people around him, whether it's the Republican Party, they're invested in their own power, in their own struggles. They don't see and they don't talk. You know, what motivates us to see and relinquish our own safety and security for the benefit of other people? It's a huge question.
Thank you so much. You're breaking my heart somewhat, but you're mending it at the same time. This room should be filled with men. Mm-hmm. The phrase that struck me was the tyranny of misogyny, and it's a tyranny over men as well as women. And I hope there's ways that can be devised, either in schools or some way, that more men hear your message.
Well, one way would be for you as a man to get your man friend to do a book group with the book and to come together and talk about what the issues in the book provoke. Because I think men talking about this together would be a very profound thing. And we're going to do a play of it. It's going to be a theatrical event. But I really do believe that in our smaller communities, we need to be talking, men need to be talking to each other about these issues and what's coming up. Because my experience now, only in the last few weeks with this book, is that men are desperate to talk. And they want to be figuring out a way to get out of this. And I'm going to believe the best about men until I can't. Do you know? And what you said about the tyranny of patriarchy, you know, there's a story in the book about my father. And, you know, as I said, I conjured a lot of this. But one morning, my father woke me up literally when I was writing this book at 4 o'clock in the morning, and he said, go to your office, I want to tell you this story. And literally, that's how this book happened. He would literally wake me up, he would push me, he would just like, all right, I want to tell you this. And I went to the office, and he told me this story, that when he was a little boy, he found this baby bird on the ground, and he picked up the baby bird, and he held the baby bird in his hands, and he said he felt like he had the whole universe in his hands. And he was just in wonder and awe. And, you know, wonder and awe are such a form of generosity, right? You have to be vulnerable to feel, you have to open yourself to the cosmos to feel that. And he was in this incredible state of rapture. And his mother found him, her perfect adored boy. And she screamed, you know, what are you doing, you idiot? It's a dirty bird. And she smacked the bird, and the bird fell on the ground, and it died. And she wouldn't let my father touch the bird. And she wouldn't let my father cry. And I swear to you, those moments determine our life. They determine whether we're going to feel when we're lying atop a woman who's saying no, whether we're going to hear her or feel how she doesn't want something because either we've cut off our hearts or we haven't cut off our hearts. So I think how we bring up our boys to be tender, to be open, to be affectionate, to be loving, to be confused, to be doubtful, to not know everything, right? To be in wonder. Just our boys to be in wonder and to let them have wonder will determine so much of the men they get to be. Thank you for bringing that up and saying that.
Thank you, Eve Ensler.
Thank you all so much. Really.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.